While someone's phone blared, "I can't understand you. Say something." It was the phone belonging to Judge Raymond Vogt. In his courtroom, during a court trial, in a courtroom that had no tolerance for electronic devices. Attorneys, police, witnesses, spectators, all have broken the rule and received punishment for similar crimes. How would he apply his rule to himself? Well, at the next trial break, he got up and admitted to the courtroom that he did indeed bump his phone. He said, "That's an excuse. I don't accept those excuses from anyone." He held himself in contempt and paid the $25 fine. That is a man of character. If the people of the court are to maintain a standard, the leader must maintain the standard. And that's what Judge Vogt did. In a similar way, the Lord looks to examples in his church. Men of character to lead the church, to be examples for the flock. This morning we'll see a few qualifications. Qualifications for elders so that the flock have tangible examples to view. Now with that said, some of you are breathing a sigh of relief. Because what you just heard is that this sermon is for church leaders. This text in 1 Timothy 3 doesn't apply to me. This means I can work on my grocery list or fill in my sermon notes with some creative drawings. Well, I can assure you this would not be to your advantage. For the character qualifications of 1 Timothy 3 apply to all believers. Indeed, you will find the characteristics of 1 Timothy 3 throughout the New Testament. And they will apply to Christians. Christians who are not necessarily leaders. You see, God's will is that every Christian be a man or woman of character. So as you hear this, let us not think only of church leaders, but let us examine our own lives as well. And if you're anything like me, you will find that this text will be quite humbling. When I entered pastoral ministry, when I came here, I thought I knew my shortcomings and my sins, but the Lord continues to reveal much, much more. There is always work to do on the heart. And today's passage reminds us of this. We must approach a passage like 1 Timothy 3 with thankfulness and with repentance. We must be thankful that the Lord loves us and that he wants more of us. But we must also be repentant. We love the Lord and want to flee from sinful patterns that can often plague our lives. All of this is quite possible because Christ can help us. Renewal or change is God's great pleasure. So with that said, I'd like to open up our Bibles to 1 Timothy 3 this morning. Last week, we began to explore God's qualifications for the church leader. And we learned that there must be a desire for the work of ministry. Yet today we'll discover that desire is not enough. Godly character must distinguish the life of the leader. 1 Timothy 3, verse 1. It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer, then, must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church, so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Our focus will be in verse 2 this morning. And we're reminded that the overseer is a leader in the church. An overseer is an elder. An overseer is a pastor. The New Testament uses these words interchangeably. We see that there are qualifications that are required. He must be. That's the imperative in verse 2. This isn't a preference. It's not a suggestion. It's not a recommendation. These are the marks of the church leader, and they must be in place. There's 15 qualifications. They're non-negotiable commands for the leader. You put that slide up for a moment. People break these qualifications down in different ways. I see really four main categories. Above reproach is the first qualification in verse 2, that second line down. It's its own qualification, though it tends to be an umbrella under which the other qualifications sit. As a church, we look to our leaders for different areas of life. There's the family life, his personal life, his life in the church, and then his life before unbelievers. So these characteristics break down in these four main categories. It's just one way to think about the marks and one way to view them. We'll start in verse 2, right where the apostle started. The overseer is above reproach. This means that the elder is blameless. Literally, it means that he is not to be laid hold of. What does that mean? Well, you can look at his life, and there's no grounds for an accusation. There's nothing to grab a hold of. One cannot bring a charge against him. He's a model man, and he's a model Christian. His deeds match his doctrine. His lips match his life. There's no besetting sin that disqualifies him from leading God's people. Now recognize that this is a man who is blameless, not sinless. The Bible teaches that we sin. 1 John 3:5, you know that he appeared in order to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. Oh, excuse me, that's speaking of Jesus. The Bible teaches that we sin. If we say that we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves, and the truth is not in us. That truth reminds us that all of us continue to wrestle with sin. The Bible teaches that Jesus alone is sinless. 1 John 3:5, as we mentioned, you know that he appeared in order to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. So in an overseer, then, you have a man who addresses his sin. He's an example of honesty, confession, repentance. Perhaps we're reminded of Daniel, that great Old Testament prophet. Daniel was appointed to a high command in the nation of Babylon. He was an exceptional administrator, very good at what he did. What can happen when people are good at their jobs? Jealousy. Daniel 6:4, the commissioners and officers began trying to find a ground for accusation against Daniel. They could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption. And as much as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Daniel was blameless. He was above reproach. There was nothing to lay hold of in his life. There was no ground of accusation. Do we not want this said of our lives? I want this set of my life. I want the Lord to look at me and see a man who is blameless. Our leaders are called to this. Our leaders are called to be blameless, to live in such a way that there's nothing to accuse them of. Specifically, to be blameless in regards to those 14 qualifications that follow. We see that the overseer is to be the husband of one wife. This is another qualification from verse 2. I'll try to present these to you without going too quickly, but at the same time, I want to give them their proper attention and spend some time on them. Paul looks first to the marriage to see what a blameless man is like. A blameless man is a husband of one wife. This may seem simple, but this qualification has received a lot of spilled ink over the years. Now, the context of any passage is going to aid us in understanding what the meaning of that verse is. That's true for this qualification. What does it mean to be the husband of one wife? Well, many would say that the elder must be married. A single man is dismissed or not considered for eldership. I don't subscribe to this view for a few reasons. I believe it forces the qualification or forces a meaning upon other qualifications. If we apply this narrow interpretation to this one, this qualification, we're going to have to do the same with qualifications that follow. For example, if he must be married, looking down at verse 4, he must also have children. Not one, but two or more to qualify for eldership. In verse 3, the elder must also consume wine. To be addicted is to drink habitually, and that could only happen if you drink wine. So this view forces a standard upon the qualifications if we're going to be consistent. You'll find as well that it does not appear as though Paul himself was married, at least when he wrote 1 Corinthians. We know Jesus was not, and this would disqualify Jesus from being an elder in churches that held this view. Paul writes about the benefits of singleness for ministry. 1 Corinthians 7, to the unmarried and to widows, it is good if they remain as I am. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. He writes of the singular focus on Christ of those that are unmarried. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. So I'm not convinced that this requirement of marriage is to be placed upon a prospective elder. A second view believes that an elder can only have one wife ever. There'd be no remarriage even in the event of death. A widowed man would not qualify for eldership. I believe this view also has its problems. Romans 7 teaches that the marriage bond is dissolved at death. Other scriptures teach that in certain circumstances, remarriage is permissible. And again, I believe that if a godly man meets the qualifications, 1 Timothy 3, this places an undue regulation upon him. An elder must not be divorced or remarried. This view has lost popularity in our culture over the past few decades as divorce rates have spiked. I don't agree with it for different reasons. There's a Greek word for divorce, but Paul does not use it here. Paul could have said, a man must not be divorced, but that was not what he worded in 1 Timothy 3:2. And on top of that, the Bible provides two biblical reasons for divorce. One is marital infidelity, and the other is desertion by an unbeliever. And frankly, a godly man who would go through that might bring a lot to the table in terms of shepherding a people. So I believe that the fourth view is the best for understanding what Paul has in mind here. The elder must be maritally pure. Why do I think this is the best view? Well, it honors the Greek. The husband of one wife literally means a one-woman man. This man has a heart, has a mind, has affections set upon one woman. He honors his marriage vows. He upholds the sanctity of marriage. The other interpretations miss the point of the passage. The whole context is a man's character in 1 Timothy 3. All the qualifications are in the present tense. We want to know, what is this man like now? We would not immediately dismiss out of hand a man who had a divorce before he came to Christ, for example. If he is married, what's his marriage like today? Now, I realize that I am a pastor who is married, and that I have embraced what is the most difficult application of the passage. You see, I would argue that this is not about marital status. Many men marry only once, and they are not one-woman men. Their hearts are divided. This goes much, much deeper, 1 Timothy 3:2, than just marital status. This goes right to the heart of a man. It's about much more than being an adulterer. He's to be a man of undivided allegiance to his wife. As the Greek reads, he's to be a one-woman man. I want church leaders to hear this, and all the husbands as well. Satan is aiming at a giant target on our backs. God's gift of marriage is under assault in our day and age. Few take their marriage vows seriously. Vows made to God. Divorce is more common or as common as staying together. And there's more garbage on the internet and on TV than in your local landfill. Men, we must have eyes for our wives only. We're to be one woman men. Leaders, our hearts must not be divided. No second glances. No emotional affairs. No divided affections. We must love our wives with a pure heart. I believe that's Paul's intent in this passage. The great British bulldog Winston Churchill was attending a dinner with dignitaries one evening, and the question was posed to everyone at the table, if you could not be who you are, who would you like to be? When it was his turn to answer, his wife by his side, Churchill rose. And he said, if I could not be who I am, I would most like to be, taking the hand of his wife, Lady Churchill's second husband. Those are the words of a one-woman man. And I just want to encourage the men here today to be a one-woman man. I know the call is for leaders, and it should be, but it's the call to all of us as husbands and future husbands to have eyes only for our wives. God would expect this of all of his sons, and God will give us the grace to be these kinds of men. Well, moving along, I want us to see that next qualification in Paul's list, and that's the qualification of temperance. The overseer is to be temperate. Originally, this term meant moderate in drink. It still means that, especially in America. We've seen a temperance movement in the 1800s, 1900s. But in the day in which Paul wrote, the definition of this term was broadening. Other authors were using this to describe more than just a freedom from drink. It also meant not to be given to an excess in any fleshly appetite, be it alcohol or something else. And we will see, by the way, Paul will address specifically alcohol in verse 3. He's not going to duplicate this qualification. Paul wants his leaders to be sober-minded. He wants leaders to be self-controlled. In his book on eldership, Alexander Strauch says it this way, negatively, temperance indicates the absence of any anything that would distort a person's judgment or control. Positively, it describes a person who is stable, circumspect, self-restrained, and clear-headed. And nothing can interfere with the elder's ability to lead. He more or less has to be on call all the time. He keeps himself free from other enslavements. That great Civil War General Robert E. Lee says it this way: "I like whiskey. I always did. And that is why I never drink it." You see, Lee was a clear thinker. He was a leader of men. He did not want anything to interfere with his ability to lead them well. How about us as the leaders of First Baptist? Is there anything that draws us from our post? Is there any bodily appetite that clouds our judgment? Do we, as the Apostle Paul says, beat our bodies and make them our slaves? Natural men are driven by selfish desires. What can make me happy? What makes me comfortable? But godly leaders are driven by selfless determination. What makes God's people holy? What makes God's people hopeful? So God's leader is to be no slave of the bodily appetite. The overseer, fourthly, is also to be prudent. This is very similar to temperance, but there's one major difference. The emphasis here is on a mental discipline. We might say it this way: if temperance is focused on bodily appetites, prudence is focused on the mind. Control of the mind. A prudent man exercises good judgment. A prudent man has common sense. A prudent man uses discretion. The Old Testament equivalent of this appears in Proverbs 8 times. It's no surprise that prudence would appear in a book about wisdom. Proverbs 12:16, the prudent man is not acting out in impulsive displays of emotion. He's able to regulate his emotions in times of testing. He's able to think before he reacts. Prudent men act with a cool head. They take the entire picture into account, Proverbs 13:16. This is the kind of mental discipline leaders need to lead a church. Objective thinking, focused on their work. Quick to listen, slow to speak. The church elders to be prudent. We see he's also to be respectable. "Will we live your glorious days in social studies?" Let me quote to you James Madison: "No government, any more than an individual, will long be respected without being truly respectable. Nor be truly respectable without possessing a certain portion of order and stability." So a respectable person is dignified. Their life commands respect. There's an admiration or a high regard for this person. This isn't respectful. Hopefully our leaders are still respectful. They're not cutting you off for your parking spot out front. Another important characteristic, but it's respectable. This has to do with a well-ordered life. Homer Kent has said it this way: "The ministry is no place for a man whose life is a continual confusion of unaccomplished plans and unorganized activity." A great leader needs to be stable. An inward stability reflects itself in an outward life. And the church looks to him. They see a man who's respectable. And his living has earned this. If you look back at 1 Timothy 2:9, the same word is used of a woman's clothing. "Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with respectable clothing." This goes to remind us that how a woman dresses impacts the respect that she gets. And the display of one's life to a watching world will impact the respect that individual gets. In our context, Paul would say it's important for the leader to evoke respect, to live in such a way that people respect him. And lastly, this morning, I want us to look at hospitality. That next characteristic is one of being hospitable. Love plus stranger equals love of stranger. It's a compound word in the Greek. It puts two words together, and this is just an excellent reminder for all of us. Strauch again has said, hardly anything is more characteristic of Christian love than hospitality. Hospitality is essential to fanning the flames of love and strengthening the Christian community. If you look at this word throughout the New Testament, every time it's used, it's in the context of love. Romans 12, be devoted to one another in brotherly love, practicing hospitality. Hebrews 13, let love of the brethren continue, show hospitality. 1 Peter 4, keep fervent in your love for one another, be hospitable. I know believers say they love one another, and at this church I believe it. But we must also make sure we show it. Our leaders must model this. Again, the primary audience here is the church leader. But I want to ask all of us a few hard questions this morning. When was the last time you invited someone into your home? How are your conversations with visitors during our Sunday morning services? How often do you sit with new people at our fellowship meals downstairs? I believe we all have room for improvement in this area, but I want to give you a couple of encouragements. You don't need to cook like Wolfgang Puck, and your house does not need to look like Martha Stewart's to be hospitable. My wife commented to me the other day that every time someone pops in, our house is a disaster. I think that's great. I think that keeps us humble. Besides, we have 3 saboteurs, all under the age of 8, who win that battle all the time anyway. They're like Wile E. Coyote, but always successful. So we're all in the same boat together on this. And I want to encourage you, too, you don't need to be a pro to interact with people. There's no professional social interactors, or they're very few and far between. You'll find, too, that those that you approach, those you engage in conversation with, are not professionals at conversation either. But one thing that everyone seems to notice is love that comes through hospitality, and through an inviting heart and an engaging conversation. I'm reminded of Roger Bannister. He was the guy who broke the 5-minute mile many, many years ago. For centuries, even from the time of the Greeks, no one thought you could run a mile under 5 minutes. In fact, some decided it was physically impossible. They did weird things like put you on a track and have wild animals chase you. And still no one could break the mile. But in 1954, Roger Bannister did this. And do you know what happened next? Another guy broke the mile. And then another one, and another one, and another one. And men kept breaking that 5-minute mile under 4 minutes now, 4 minutes and 50-some seconds. You see, a leader stepped out and he accomplished what seems to be the impossible. He gave an example to follow. Our church needs qualified men who will set the pace. We need men that we can look to for 1 Timothy 3 to follow in their footsteps. We already have the perfect model, the Lord Jesus Christ. He modeled all of these qualifications perfectly. And I know these qualifications can seem impossible this morning. As I read them, I feel, think of all the ways I fall short and how disappointed you must be in me as I'm teaching you this and you're thinking, that is not you. But I also realize that there's grace. And I want to keep working on this. And I want to encourage our leaders to work on this. And you, as our church family, to keep working. We rely upon the grace of God to be these kinds of people. Not that I've already obtained it or have already become perfect, but I press on so that I may lay hold of that for which Christ has laid hold of me. And that's Paul speaking. Christ has laid hold of us. And it is for this reason that we can lay hold of Christ's commands. Let me pray for us this morning.